Most of us cannot pretend to know a lot about the society and culture of Afghanistan, but we do know a few things, like the difference in status between men and women. Men rule society in Afghanistan. Women are often out of sight and out of mind. You get a better sense of the huge gulf between men and women in Afghanistan from a book written by today's guest. The Underground Girls of Kabul is about Afghan families in which the parents choose to dress up a girl as a boy. The child lives as a boy for years, enjoying greater freedom and greater status for the family. Jenny Nordberg is a correspondent and columnist for the Swedish national newspaper. Her investigative reporting work has been published more broadly, including in the New York Times. Her first stories on girls living as boys was published in the Times. Jenny has won a number of awards for her work, and she joins us now on the Jefferson Exchange. Jenny Nordberg, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
That's quite a poem in the front of the book. I would love to be anything but not an Afghan woman. Where's that from?
Oh, that's written by actually one of the young Kabul University students whom I worked with for this a bit also in Afghanistan as a translator. It's a brilliant young woman who's also a poet.
That's a gripping concept, though. I mean, she'd rather be anything in the world, and she describes the other creatures she'd like to be, but not an Afghan woman.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the point is to say, you know, who has less respect in the world than an Afghan woman, and that would be any animal, any other nationality, any other ethnicity. So it's an outcry, and I read that very early on when I met her. And I found that to be a good introduction to the book, to give an idea of how Afghan women many times will say, as a matter of fact, that I always wished I would have been born a boy.
So what was it you actually went to cover in Afghanistan in the first place? I mean, you were looking into women in society. What specific aspects were you looking at, or was it just a general examination?
Yeah, I came to Afghanistan for the first time quite late in the war in 2009 because I had this idea that I wanted to do a story on women. We had come in there in an ambitious way in 2002. And one of the things we, as the Western world and with lots of foreign aid and diplomacy and also the military presence, set out to do was to not only change Afghanistan on a whole, but also to help women after the fall of the Taliban. And that became this great political cause for many Western countries to really change the situation for women there, to bring them out of their, you know, the houses, to provide education for little girls. And I wanted to see, I wanted to get an idea of how that had gone, basically, because it was a story that seemed also to be to concern my own kind as a woman. And it did not seem to have gone very well in some regards. And I was curious about that. So I came to do a small television documentary in 2009.
And so what was daily life like for you, I wonder, as a foreign woman spending lots of time in Afghanistan, what you had to do to dress, move, talk, protect yourself, et cetera?
Well, the first thing you have to do as a foreign correspondent, male or female, is to find some very, very good people on the ground to work with. Because when you come in as a foreigner, you're essentially blind and a bit of an idiot, frankly. So you need to source the best intelligence, essentially, within Afghans themselves. So I worked with some extremely talented local journalists. I worked with several female translators. And from then, from them, you learn, and they become your ears and eyes and your mind many times, and will introduce you to society and teach you how you need to dress, what you need to do, what the customs are, not to barge in and be completely rude and presume that your customs will be their customs and your way of greeting or your presumptions. So that's how I started out. But then I think in general it's an absolute advantage to be a woman when you come in as a correspondent to a very conservative and very segregated society, because what happens then is that you, as a foreign woman, you're almost treated as a neuter by the men. They don't place the same expectations in behavior of you as they would of an Afghan woman. And also you'll have access to women and they will speak to you, whereas that might be a little harder sometimes for a male foreign correspondent. So, and Afghans are extremely polite. They will invite you to their homes, and they may not tell you the whole story at once. I mean, and then that takes some time and some reporting and many cups of tea. But Afghanistan is a good place to work. I work mostly out of Kabul, and I traveled some around to other provinces. And I had a good experience working there. It is a country at war, but I was not on the actual battlefield, if you will.
I imagine there were places you couldn't go, though, because of
fighting. Absolutely. Yes, I did not travel to the south, for instance, which was much more violent at the time and still is in parts. What I did go to investigate this custom of girls who dress as boys was that I interviewed people from there, and that's how I tried to cover more provinces than what I actually visited in person.
All right, we'll talk much more with Jenny Nordberg about the underground girls of Kabul. Bacha Posh is the term in the local language. It's about families dressing up a girl as a boy and letting that girl live as a boy, and the advantages that confers both for the girl as boy and for the family at large. Come back with Jenny Nordberg and talk more about the underground girls of Kabul. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well. And let me remind you, because I forgot to mention at the top of the show, if you missed the information about our pledge drive, we got close to $191,700. So about $1,700 more than we were looking for, which is great. Thank you so much for your support of Jefferson Public Radio. The Jefferson Exchange continues in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking today to the Swedish journalist Jenny Nordberg, widely published. She has a book out called The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. It's about Afghan families that dress a girl up as a boy and let her live her life as a boy, obviously with some limits in later years. We'll find out more about why this goes on, and you can join the discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. And that's anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. You can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Jenny, you talked about your ability to move about the country and get to know Afghan women in particular. And we quickly meet through your offices, Azita. Tell us about her and what she was doing.
I walked into Azita's house when she was about 35. She was a mother of four, and she had been elected to the Afghan parliament in Kabul as one of very few women there. There was a 25% quota of women instituted after the Taliban left in the new parliament. And she was one of those women. She had come from a very poor northern province together with her family. And I knew her as a woman with three daughters and a son, a youngest child that was a son. And I came to interview her about what it's like to be a politician and a woman in a very rare breed in Afghanistan. And I happened to be speaking to her oldest twin daughters in another room when one of them said to me, you know, our brother is really a girl. And the other one filled in and she said, this is our sister. And when I then met their youngest brother, I just had no idea what they were talking about, because this is a six-year-old child and someone who looked exactly like the sisters, but with a short haircut, a pair of pants, a denim shirt, a very different body language, much more of an attitude, hips forward. To me, it looked completely like a boy. So my whole purpose of interviewing Azita became a little confusing, but I was too scared to say anything because I thought that maybe I hadn't done my homework right on Afghanistan. Maybe this was something that they did. Maybe the sisters were just making fun of me. I had no idea. So I kept quiet for quite a while.
And does Azita speak English?
She speaks English. She's very well educated. So we communicated directly.
Mm-hmm. And so this was how long between the time that the girls giggling told you about their brother being a girl, and then Azita happened to mention it to you, too.
Well, it took a few hours. We talked about a lot of things, and I was hoping that the conversation would turn to her children eventually. And then at one point she did say, I have four daughters. And that was my moment of thinking, oh, please continue. And she She just volunteered. She said, you know, we dress our youngest like a boy. And then I tried to keep face and show no emotion. And I said, uh-huh. Why is that? and she just came out and said it again in a very matter-of-fact way. She said it was problematic for her as a politician to have only daughters. She was constantly being questioned, even in her political work. Why can't you have a son? What's wrong with you? How can we trust that you can accomplish anything at all when you can't even bring your family and your husband a son? Because in Afghanistan, this is considered to be the responsibility of a woman to bear a son, and that she can actually affect this by herself. And she said that was giving her entire family a hard time. So one day they took five-year-old Manoush, as their youngest daughter was called, to the barber and cut off her hair and put her in pants and had her then posed to the outside world as the family son. And something that Mehran, which was the tweaking of her name, just fell right into, because in that way, it also opened up the world much more. She could go out, she could play. The second big thing that happened with the family was that in addition to helping Azita's work and the family's social standing, was that the youngest child, Mehran, could also escort her older sisters as a boy. So it provided more freedom movement for the entire family and for all of the daughters. And then thirdly, Azita said to me, and this was the most interesting part to me, she said, I wanted to show my youngest what life is like on the other side. So that hinted at something subversive that I thought was interesting.
It really is. We're talking to Jenny Nordberg about her book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, about girls who are passed as boys in Afghan society. So let us broaden the scope then and talk about Afghan society more broadly. You were talking about how women are their responsibility is to bear a son. So it's not just a matter of people thinking, well, darn, you didn't have a boy. I mean, women are blamed. They are really held responsible for not bearing boys. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, it's a largely illiterate country, and many people actually believe, and including some doctors, that it is up to the woman to affect her own body to conceive a male child. And the reason why this is so important, one should add also, is that it's one of the world's poorest countries. It's a deeply patriarchal society where men make all the decisions. Men usually work outside the house. They're completely financially responsible for the family. And daughters will eventually be married off into other families, whereas sons are expected to stay with their parents, bring new wives and children into the family, support their parents when they get old, carry on the family name. So if you don't have a son in Afghanistan as a family, and this goes for both men and women, you're not only seen as weak and perceived as weak, you are actually also weak. It might be harder to get a job, to get a loan, you'll be dismissed by neighbors and colleagues and the extended family. It's an actual practical problem not to have a son.
So in a sense, you're people from the other side of the tracks if you're a family of only girls?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
In a sense, you're like the family from the other side of the tracks. You're like from the poor side of town if there are no boys in your family.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge problem, and people will look down on you. They will not only blame the woman, the wife, they may also chastise the husband to say, you know, you're a man whose woman bear only daughters. There's a slur for that in the Dari language, for instance.
Is that Doktar Zai?
Yes. the man whose woman can bear only girls, and it's a weak man. It's someone who doesn't fulfill his role as an actual strong Afghan man.
Wow, it's really hard to grasp the concept because it is so different from the, well, I would like to think it's so different anyway from the way we live in the West, but anyway, we'll move on through this. So walk us through the changeover then. I mean, how did they go about turning Manoush into Mehran?
Well, what happens is that, what happened to Mehran, and I followed her for several years, is that she fell into this role very easily. I was curious to see right away if there were other families who did this. And I asked around, and then none of the foreigners and the experts I consulted were aware of this practice. So, but it turned out that every single Afghan knew someone. They had, you know, they had a brother. They had someone in their extended family. There might be had been a great grandmother who was legendary in the family and rode horses and used to shoot guns. And so it's a fairly widespread. It's not the majority, of course, but it's not uncommon. And I found quite a few little girls, and essentially also then eventually young women who lived like this. And I followed the life cycle, if you will, of these girls, and also interviewed quite a few adult women who spoke about the transition that they had to go through when one day, and it does happen very much overnight, because when you when you're about to enter puberty, when you begin to menstruate as a young woman, that is the cutoff time. Whatever liberties you have experienced up until that point, and again, you know, this may not be all about freedom. It could mean that you have worked outside the house as a boy and supported your family, which is then child labor and not so much about freedom. So this can have several aspects to it. But again, that's around puberty is when the curtain comes down for these girls, and when it's time to conform back into Afghan society and become a proper young woman who will be groomed for marriage to a husband of her parents' choice. And this can be very tricky.
Well, obviously, the book is called The Underground Girls of Kabul in Search of Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. Jenny Nordberg wrote it, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the families that have made this change, and as you point out, everybody knew somebody who'd done it, is it an open secret kind of thing where people know what goes on, but they don't talk about it?
Yes, that's a good description. I came to think of it as a don't ask, don't tell of Afghan society. Everybody knows that it's going on. Most people know someone or know of someone. There's usually one child in a school, for instance. Doctors will know about this practice because little boys are brought in and turn out to be girls. And it's not condemned. It's largely accepted in Afghan society. Some people may not choose to do it with their own child, but I think it would be my estimation, or what I've been told at least, is that every family with only girls, only daughters, will consider something like this. It's in fact even better, seen as better in Afghan society to have a made-up son than no son at all.
And the term is bacha posh, is that right?
Dressed up like a boy. And when I found that there's an actual term for these children, the Afghans can even say in conversation, they can say, there's a son or a daughter, there's a bacha posh. So it's almost talked about as a third gender. When I found this term, I think that confirmed to me that it was not an anomaly.
Huh. So a third kind of gender then, essentially. You got boys, you got girls, you got bacha posh.
Yeah.
Wow. So what activities? I mean, you began to list some of the things that bacha posh can do. Basically, everything a boy can do, a bacha posh does?
Yes. Afghanistan is such an extremely segregated society, meaning even in children many times, boys do certain things and girls do other things, and girls hang out with other girls. And it's how they're groomed for later in life. So girls are told that they can't, you know, many times they can't go outside much, and if they do, they should not be too wild and jump up and down. Riding a bike, for instance, can be controversial for young girls and women there. Climbing a tree, anything that has to do with being too physical, that can be seen as aggressive and will be looked down upon, because a girl is supposed to be extremely pure and sheltered and guarded until the time that she marries. And this, of course, goes back to the whole ideal of purity in the culture of honor, when a girl should ideally not even have had any contact with the other sex before she gets married, because then you can ensure and trust that she's the virgin.
So when the transition has to be made back to girl in puberty for a bacha posh, what happens? I mean, do they suddenly get moved back to the girl side of the school? I mean, is there any shock and revelation or anything like that? Or, I mean, I'm just curious. And then what happens to the family status as well?
Yeah, I mean, this is also surprisingly casual when it comes to the environment there. Sometimes there's a party thrown for the girl when she will be put in a dress and the relatives will visit. Many times it's not made a big deal out of this. And for the child herself, it can be difficult, though. I mean, what my research shows is that and again, this is anecdotal, but it's what I have, is that the girls who spend a few years as young children on the other side, so to speak, they can speak of this in adult age as a somewhat empowering experience. They learn that they were equal to men in many regards, that they, you know, their bodies could be strong and they had minds that worked and they could speak up and they could look people in the eye. So they'll carry that with them in adult age. And some of these former Bachapush then go on to become ministers or business women, or those very rare Afghan women who actually can have a professional life, for instance, and some power in society. But for those women who pushed it into puberty, beyond puberty even, they describe it as a much more complicated experience and transition, in the sense that the masculine, as they describe it, will stay with them forever. They will feel more naturally, so to speak, male than female. And it's something that they struggle with a lot. So I think, in my mind, it does have a lot to do with puberty. When you go into puberty, which is difficult for anyone, and trying to figure out who you are, that's when it might become much more complicated for the Bachapush who push it. It also becomes more controversial, and because that's when segregation does not allow for young women of childbearing age to reach for the rights that they're not supposed to have in Afghan society. When it's children, it doesn't matter that much. People don't care. But when we talk about teenagers, and those are fewer, the Bachapush in that category, it becomes more of a controversial issue.
Jenny Nordberg, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about girls posing as boys in Afghanistan. Her book is The Underground Girls of Kabul. So you really can look at this a couple of ways. In fact, more than a couple, I'm sure. But on the one hand, there's the sense that, oh boy, it really does take a male and a family to make a family have any status in Afghanistan. But on the other hand, it also does provide some sense of a taste of freedom anyway for the Bachapush.
Yes, I think that I spent a very long time, and I've been researching this for the past 5 years back and forth to Afghanistan. I think I had this idea for a very long time that I needed to find out if this was good or bad. Was it something that could be described as empowering, a measure of freedom, something subversive, or was it in fact a tragedy that these are women and young girls who essentially give up on their own gender because society makes it so difficult to be a woman there? And I think that what I've come up with now is that, first of all, it's not my place to judge or to come down with a judgment on that. And also that it's both. You know, this is a subversive measure, and it does include an element of freedom. But it's also a concession to an impossible society where only men count. So, yeah, there's tragedy and there's some resistance in this, both at the same time. And it's individual for each child also. Again, this could mean child labor, or it could mean going to school. So is it a mother or parents who do something to their children or for their children? It could be both or either.
I'm glad you mentioned going to school, because you provide some literacy figures on Afghanistan that are just shocking. And what is the general level of literacy in the population?
Well, in some areas, it's no more than 10%, and it's worse for women. Again, this goes back to what we've been talking about, because if there's a chance to go to school, the boys will be sent first. Those are seen as the ones to invest in for Afghan parents. And as a practical measure, it might be too dangerous for a girl to even take the journey to school if you live in an insecure area. That's where the Bachapush also may come in, because disguised as a boy, you may be able to actually get to the school. So there could be that factor as well.
But despite the great rate of illiteracy, don't underestimate the Afghan people, because as you point out, there's a lot to be said for their oral tradition and the way that things are passed down there.
Yes, and that's what I learned, because I'm a foreigner and I'm a traditional journalist, so I did what we do. I looked in the archives and I asked the experts, and when none of that really turned out, I discarded all that, and I began to do very old school journalism, which was to speak to every single person I found, and I asked them for referrals, I asked them for their family histories. And it turned out that there is the story of a Bachapoosh in many families, and they're happy to tell it.
Much more about Bachapoosh, girls posing as boys in Afghanistan. The book is The Underground Girls of Kabul. Jenny Nordberg wrote it. She's our guest on The Exchange, and you can join us when we return in a minute 15. We're into the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Jenny Nordberg. She is a correspondent and columnist for a Swedish national newspaper, but her investigative reporting work has been published in the New York Times and many other places. She is a winner of several awards for her work and the author of a book called The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. And it's about families dressing up girls as boys, because boys have much greater status in Afghan society and increase the status of the family as well. Bachapoosh, they're called. Join us on The Exchange as we talk about this. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Or email us at jx@jeffnet.org. We do get some smatterings of languages used in Afghanistan, and there's this interesting line of priorities, Zan, Zarwa, Zamin, which tells us something about the treatment of women in Afghanistan going beyond tradition.
Yes, it's a Pashtun expression, and it traditionally describes what we fight about, or what Pashtuns fight about, and it's women, gold, and land in that order, which also goes to the point that women are at the core of conflict, and protecting women and fighting over women is something that is very deeply rooted in this culture.
But it sounds like the value of a woman, particularly when you talk about girls not riding bicycles, not climbing trees, trying to remain pure, it sounds like the value of women in most of the traditional Afghan culture you examined is as vessels for boys, to give birth to boys.
Yes, that's true. And the one who has, the man who has a woman who can produce many sons, it's a strong man, a real Afghan, if you will. This is the traditional thing that we see in our own history, when only men could inherit property, for instance. If you didn't have a son, it was pretty much a disaster. So, again, having more than one wife increases the chances of having even more sons. So you'll see in you know the Middle Ages in Europe, and you'll see popular culture depicting very very old long gone eras how important this is, and how women would be traded for marriage or to expand your property or to make a deal with a neighbor, and this is how our culture was created many times.
I don't feel like I'm doing the book justice up to this point, because we've been talking in general terms, but the fact is you introduce us to a number of really interesting people, some really interesting characters in here, not the least of whom is Dr. Fareba, the maker of sons. Tell us about the doctor.
Oh yes, after meeting Azita and setting out to find other families and other children who were girls posing as boys, I felt that I also needed to understand what the point was of all this. Why are sons so important here? And one of the most interesting people I came upon was this Afghan doctor, a woman who has worked since the Soviet era. Women doctors were always given an exception, even by the Taliban, because they were the only ones who could care for women. And she also freelances on the side to help Afghan families and women to conceive sons. And she has all these potions and powders and herbs and instructions for how to make a woman's womb more more inviting to conceiving a male child and more to have that happen sooner. She will also give advice to men about this. And this is what we would call new age in our world, but that's essentially old age in that part of the world. And it has a lot to do with mystical components, and it's certainly pre-Islamic in many ways, and you can track this practice back to a pre-Islamic time in Afghanistan as well. And she calls herself the maker of sons, because she would charge a little extra on the side and advise women on how to have sons, because this also goes to the heart of the population question. A woman who will have 3-4 sons right away, she's good, she's done well. Whereas a woman who will give birth to a girl and then another, maybe 3-4 in a row, she will keep trying for a son. So she may have 6, 7, 8 children, and which is also extremely hard on the body and hard for women, since they marry at a very young age, and to be pregnant every single year.
In fact, you met one woman, I believe, who had 10 children, ages 1 to 20, but there was something that she said, I think, about focusing on her, on a girl to be a boy, ended up producing a boy next time around.
Yes, this is one of the another one of the reasons to turn your daughter into a son. Again, where society is largely illiterate, and there's much trust placed in myth. Myth and oral myth is much more powerful than any government decree or anything that you might read, and this is how information is passed around. So many Afghans believe that if you see something that looks like a son in front of you every day, you will eventually also have an actual son. This is what we call manifestation many times. Remember that book, The Secret? You know, you see
believe it,
and then all of a sudden you have it. It's that thing in Afghanistan.
Wow. So did you get a chance, Jenny, in your research to talk to anybody who'd been a bachaposh and then had, you know, obviously reached puberty and switched back to the female side and what her life was like?
Yes, the book depicts pretty much my own curiosity, where I try to follow the life cycle of these women. And eventually when I spoke to children, to teenagers, I wanted to find out what it was like to have done that and gone back. And it turned out that there were two categories of women, those who were fully women, and those were in the majority. They were mothers and wives, and no one could ever guess that they had at one point been growing up as boys. And then there were a few women who remained their entire life as men in Afghan society. Very few of those, and I would say that that's rare according to what I found. But I did interview quite a few of these women as well who talked about what it did to them or for them and what remained in them many times of the male.
And did they see an opportunity and perhaps hold out a hope that someday that daughters would be given some more freedoms to live in ways more similar to boys?
Yes, I think that I learned a lot in Afghanistan about gender. I came in with my ideas of the right to be this or that or what that meant. Afghans taught me a lot about gender. They also taught me a lot about freedom. Because I think many times we have this idea that we're going to teach them about equal rights and gender parity and all those things. But Afghan women have a very distinct sense, in my experience, of what freedoms they have and what they don't have. I mean, for instance, I asked this question of a lot of women, both those who had been bachaposh and just, you know, women who had always been girls and women. I said, what's the difference between men and women? And I kept asking that question because I wanted to hear their version of it. And you can imagine how someone in our society might elaborate on that, right? And it would be controversial in some cases. But Afghan women came back very often and they said, well, freedom. And I said, what do you mean? Like, what's the difference between men and women? And they were like, freedom, not that much else. And that stunned me. And it took a few times of getting that answer before that sunk in. Because to me, as much as this is a fascinating gender story, and, you know, and what's male and what's female and all that in us, it's at its core, it's also a story about freedom. What would you do if you could choose between staying in the house or walking out the door, looking like something or someone else? I mean, when you put it like that, yeah, it's a story. You know, it is about oppression, and it's something that humans do when they're desperate. And it's something that we have seen in our own history as well. When you single out one category, like apartheid, persecution due to religion, for instance, there will always be those who try and get over to the other side. So it's more human than Afghan, exotic, strange, in my view. As strange as it is, it also begins to make sense, to me at least.
It is the answer for how to achieve more than you're allowed to achieve within the construct of the society you have. So this brings us back around then to asking more about Azita, the first person we meet in the book. I mean, she's a member of parliament and had an interesting life herself. How did she end up being in parliament, and what did her husband think of this?
Well, Azita grew up under the communist regime in Afghanistan before the Mujahideen, before the Taliban. And she got an education and had great plans for herself. And then there was war, and none of that panned out. She was forced to be married to her first cousin. They fled to this faraway province. But then when the Americans and the Allied forces came in, she saw a chance to make something of her life again. And she managed to convince her husband that she should start to volunteer work. So she taught herself English, she became a translator, she worked with the Red Cross and some other aid organizations, and she garnered quite a reputation in her home province as the woman who could fix things, as a woman who knew basic medical care, as someone who was educated. So when it was time to then elect a new parliament to Kabul, there was the mandated 25% quota of women, and she borrowed money. She borrowed $200 and ran, and she won. And that then took her back to Kabul with her family. And then the promise to her husband was then, of course, that if you let me do this, I'll support the family. It'll be easier for you. So they did strike a deal in that way.
And so I'm curious about the treatment in Parliament, though. I mean, are the women treated as anything even remotely like equals by the men, who are probably 75% of Parliament?
No, many times not. It's very difficult to be heard as a woman. The whole idea of women's rights, for instance, is seen as by many as something Western-imposed, something un-Islamic. Quite a few of the women in Parliament are also placeholders for powerful warlords, for instance. Mm. And then there are a few women who have a voice. They have a legacy. They're usually quite wealthy women from you know, big and strong Afghan families who have made a difference and who are able to do actual political work. But it's still in its very beginnings, if you will. I mean, it's a great number to have 25%, and it's more than many Western countries have, but they don't leave the same mark on Afghan politics. Azita had a very hard time to actually make things happen, well, much like in our political system, perhaps.
Let's take a call. We have Connie and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jenny Nordberg, the author of The Underground Girls of Kabul.
Hi, good morning. It's a fascinating subject. I just want to put in a brief, sort of personalize it for Western society, supposedly. My grandmother was having most of her children in between the 1910 and 1920 era, was basically told by my grandfather that she must keep having children until she had a son. And unfortunately, she had many complications with her pregnancies. And I mean, she was literally carried upside down to keep blood flowing to her brain to the hospital. And she had five, six daughters, and then finally had a son. And so he literally was willing to risk the death of my grandmother for the what he considered the necessity of having a son.
Huh. Okay, interesting perspective to add, certainly, to put things in context. Thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate it. And that's a good reminder to us, Jenny, that that wasn't that long ago in our culture.
Yeah, I love that comment. Thank you so much for bringing that up. It's, you know, my grandmothers or great-grandmothers certainly did not decide who they married. They did not decide whether they wanted to have children or when and with whom. So, yes, we come from this society, too, where men made all the decisions. And there are still people who get quite upset when things like birth control and women choosing for themselves come up.
We have an email from Sharon that I'm going to have to really condense. She studied Eastern and Western women in the Crusader era. She just wants to know if on the modern end of this, if there's been an investigation of transgender women to men in Afghanistan.
Women to men, was that the question?
Yes.
I think that's a somewhat tricky topic because I try to go into that in the book. What we describe as transgender and our definition of that in a Western society, and we're still working this out to a great degree, is not directly applicable on a country at war, one of the poorest countries on earth, where this is done out of necessity. So that's the first thing I would say. And then also, it does happen, though, that, like I said, some of these women who live as men actually become men, in a sense. At least that's how they feel.
All right. The book is really fascinating and worth a read. The Underground Girls of Kabul in Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. Jenny Nordberg wrote it, and she's been our guest. Jenny, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.